We are down to the NFL playoffs now. College football has ended. Georgia just blew up TCU in the championship game. I told you there was a possibility for that to happen, and we'd know by the end of the first half if Georgia was going to rout TCU. But a great season for the Horned Frogs. Nonetheless, we'll talk a little bit more about the national championship game here in a second. Going to have NFL legend Greg Bingham on the show. He played linebacker for the Houston Oilers for 12 seasons in the 1970s and 1980s. Greg is going to talk about Franco Harris and the special talent he had that set him apart from other running backs. He's also going to share some really valuable insight as to how he read plays from his middle linebacker position. This is stuff that you can even use at home watching games. You'd be surprised at how many clues there are during a game to let you know if the offense is going to run or pass. Of course, knowing what the offense is going to do is one thing. Stopping it is another. As if all that is not awesome enough, Minnesota Vikings legend Chuck Foreman will also join the show. Chuck Foreman, number 44 for the Vikings, helped the team earn 3 NFC titles. A very historically underrated player, in my opinion. If you were lucky enough to watch the NFL in the 1970s, you likely know what I'm talking about. Chuck Foreman was an exceptional player, and most importantly, an all-around player with a lot of intangibles that you can't measure on a stat sheet. If you're new to the show, welcome. I know there are some new stations this week. The purpose of the Game Before the Money radio show is to give you a greater appreciation for what's really happening in football based on player and coach perspectives and based on my historical perspective. I've been watching football since the 1970s and have also been fortunate enough to have in-depth interviews with some of the all-time legends of the game. So this show doesn't get into gossip and who said what in the locker room and so-called storylines. As a longtime fan, I don't really pay attention to that stuff. That's not football. And you can get that other stuff all over the place. I'm here to chat straight up, lifelong fan kind of football topics. And that's what you're going to hear from two NFL legends in the next segments, Greg Bingham and Chuck Foreman. Before that, I'm going to chat some NFL and sum up the college football national championship. Georgia, wow, they blew the doors off of TCU. And last week I said that was a real possibility, but I was thinking winning by like 25 points or so. 65-7? Whoa. A lot of times I can dig back in the memory bank and remember a similar game, but it's really tough to remember something like that in a national championship game. Nebraska, of course, dominated Florida and put up 62 points back in that first Bowl Alliance championship for the 1995 season. But even that game didn't come close to as dominant of a performance. And as I pointed out last week, my concern for TCU was, although they had a playmaking secondary, adding a tight end like Brock Bowers to cover, it just overwhelmed TCU's pass defense. 5 Georgia players had receptions of at least 20 yards. Moving on to the NFL. The NFL playoffs this weekend, 7 teams per conference. That's a lot. So you have some very inconsistent teams in there. But for the teams playing this week, you only have to win 2 games to make the conference championship, right? Any of these teams can win 2 straight games. 3 gets you into the Super Bowl. Looking at this week's game, first I'd like to look at Dallas at Tampa Bay. Tom Brady took a lot of criticism this year, and I admit he doesn't look like vintage Tom Brady, but if one of these younger quarterbacks led the NFL in completions, was 3rd behind Mahomes and Justin Herbert in passing yards, and had the 3rd lowest interception percentage in the league, the networks would be going crazy over the guy. Amazingly, Tom Brady topped Joe Burrow in all those categories. He had a monster season. I know that Tampa Bay threw the ball a lot this year, and that helped Brady amass some of those statistics that left him number one in completions and so high in passing yards. But I just want to say this one last time. If you want to sleep on Tom Brady in the playoffs, if you don't think he can lead a team to winning two playoff games in a row and get to the NFC Championship game, just feel free to do that. You still don't want to be in a close game with Brady late. According to Pro Football Reference, only Kirk Cousins had more game-winning drives than Tom Brady this year. So Tom Brady is one of the reasons why this Cowboys-Buccaneers game is really tough to predict. The other variable is the Cowboys' inconsistency. But if the Cowboys find a way to win this game, that could clear some things up because beating the Brady-led Buccaneers has really been an obstacle for the Cowboys the past 2 years. Two emotional losses. But if they get over the hump, that might give Dallas some real momentum throughout the playoffs. Tampa Bay might be 8-9, but they lost four games by 6 points or less. So that record might be a little bit deceptive, but the Buccaneers do have a negative 45-point differential this year. This game could really go in a lot of directions. Dallas should win, I think, but my biggest concern about that are the Cowboys' inconsistency this year. And Brady has both Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, who both had over 1,000 yards receiving this year. Two receivers like that is kind of a tough matchup for the Cowboys secondary, especially if this game is close late. There are three games this week between divisional rivals, which are also tough to predict in the playoffs. Miami is at Buffalo. The Ravens are at the Bengals. Seattle is at San Francisco. I'm going to talk first about Miami at Buffalo. Tua is out. Skylar Thompson is touted as likely being Miami's starting quarterback as this is being recorded. Hard to say what a rookie can do in the playoffs. Buffalo really has a lot of advantages in this game. Occasionally, teams with nothing to lose play over their heads, especially against division rivals. And Tyreek Hill always has a chance to change the dynamics of a game. I think those two things really have to happen for Miami to have a chance. But Buffalo should overpower the Dolphins in Buffalo. More about the Bills in a second. Over the past couple of weeks, the two teams that I thought looked most likely to go to the Super Bowl are the Bengals and the 49ers. These wildcard games against divisional rivals might be a real tough test, but I don't see the Ravens really challenging Cincinnati if Lamar Jackson is out. And the Christian McCaffrey trade really brought something special to the 49ers. So I do see the Bengals and 49ers as having the best chance to win their conferences. Now, you might be asking, why not Buffalo in the AFC? Well, two things. First, to me, is a running game. Times have changed. You don't need a dominant running game to win a championship, but you do need to have a running game that's good enough to consistently run out the clock when needed. I personally haven't seen that consistency enough from the Bills to greenlight them all the way. Secondly, Buffalo doesn't have the clock management down the way Kansas City and Cincinnati does. We're getting down to brass tacks here, but that's a big part of the game, and especially in the playoffs. Buffalo is really going to have to control games through the fourth quarter against their toughest playoff opponents, and that would be a really tall task against the Bengals and Kansas City, especially if they had to play those two teams back-to-back. So I think that running game issue and the clock management issue, one or both of those things, are going to eventually do in the Bills. Real quick, Giants at Minnesota, Chargers at Jaguars. The same week, the Vikings had their record-setting comeback against the Colts. I had 49ers legend Randy Cross on this show, and he spoke about the confidence the 49ers had after coming back from a 35-7 deficit to win. He said that after that, no matter what the score was, they were always confident that they could still win the game. So that Vikings win over the Colts, that could pay big dividends for Minnesota in this playoffs and in the future. As for the Chargers-Jaguars, I mean, it's tough to really say which one of those great college quarterbacks are able to win in the NFL playoffs. I've seen the Jaguars quite a bit this season, and a lot of the times they've looked pretty terrible. But they've hung around enough in some games to sneak out a win. And that's really Jacksonville's kind of secret sauce. They just kind of grind it out no matter what the score is. Both of these teams are hot. Jacksonville's won 5 straight, and the Chargers have won 5 of their last 7. Personally, I think head coach Doug Peterson kind of makes Jacksonville a little bit of a dark horse. He won the Super Bowl with Nick Foles at quarterback. It's a very short list of NFL coaches who won championships with their second string quarterback. And he snuck out a wild card win against a 12-4 Bears team with a 9-7 Eagles team. Peterson played under Don Shula and Mike Holmgren. He knows how to win. And the more the Jaguars win these ugly games, the more they're going to learn how to win. Now, those of you who have listened to this show regularly, you probably know I love to talk about how Jimmy Garoppolo is like the 1983 Chicago White Sox, winning ugly. Well, if the Jacksonville Jaguars win a couple of playoff games, they could also fall into that winning ugly category. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Also, check out the Game Before the Money podcast. Up next, an interview with former Houston Oilers linebacker Greg Bingham. All right, Greg Bingham on the line. Played 12 years in the National Football League as an inside linebacker for the Houston Oilers. That team is now known as the Tennessee Titans. Greg was the defensive play caller for the Oilers defense. In this segment, he's going to tell us why NFL players sometimes call the 3-4 defense the 3-2. He's going to talk about the 1979 AFC Divisional Playoff where the Oilers played the Chargers. He's going to let us know how the Oilers defense knew whether the Chargers were going to run or pass on every single play. He's also going to give insight into the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers offense and running back Franco Harris. Here's former NFL linebacker Greg Bingham. So you grew up in Chicago.
I did.
How closely did you follow the Bears or Notre Dame while you were growing up?
I took the bus to my high school and went right by Wrigley Field every single day. And I spent a lot of time at Wrigley Field because my parents were pretty big sports fans, if you know what I'm saying. And I just had a blast there. I mean, I really did. In fact, I'm going to tell you something. I was an expert at 12 years old of getting extra point kicks. Not field goals, because field goals vary in the distance. But extra points is pretty consistent. So I figured out real early that if I went to this section and I put my foot on the railing, and when the kick was in the air, I just jumped into the air, and I didn't have to worry about landing on any infrastructure or chairs or anything, because everybody was up doing the same thing, trying to catch the football, and they'd catch me and I'd fall on them. So I got about 15 footballs that way.
When you were a kid, catching extra points at Bears games.
Absolutely, man. It was great.
Wow, that's awesome. Was Gail Sayers playing then, or who was who were the Bears stars?
Gail Sayers was there, Ronnie Bull, and something neat. And that neat thing was Richie Pettibone was the free safety.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to Washington Redskins, and then he came to Houston and was my coach.
Oh, wow, that's neat. That's full circle.
That's a full circle. It really is. You can't make that stuff up, you know?
You can't. So you were drafted in the 4th round in 1973. Back then, you know, the draft wasn't really covered. How did you find out you were drafted?
You're exactly right. They didn't tell you on TV. I think they called me on the phone. You know, technology wasn't as big as it was. Don't forget, there was no internet. There was nothing.
Had you expected to be drafted?
You know, I think I did, yeah. The guy who stood up for me, I gotta tell you something, because his name was Bruce Kebrick. He was a scout. And Sid Gilman was the head coach here. You know that Sid Gilman is the only coach in the history of football to be in both in a college and professional Hall of Fame? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
That's pretty cool.
That's a great piece of trivia right there.
It is a great piece of trivia. And I got to tell you, what a brilliant guy. Love that guy to death. And I remember him coming up to me and saying, Greg, we're going to have to find out real quick whether you can take this job or not. So we're starting you the first preseason game. And then he came up to me the second game and said, Greg, you did pretty good against the pass, but not so good against the run. So the next game, I did real good against the run. And he comes to me the third game and says, can you please put the two of these together in one game? And so I did. And they cut the guy whose job I took.
Now, were the Oilers running a 4-3 when you first got there?
They were. I was 4-3. That's exactly right.
And you played the middle linebacker position.
Right. And we went to the 3-2.
The 3-4. The 3-2?
Well, we call it 3-2.
Is it the standard 3-4 or is it different?
No, it's the same thing. 3-4 and a 3-2 is the same thing.
And why do the pros call it a 3-2?
Because you got two middle linebackers, that's why.
Oh, okay. There's a little insight there. Well, at that time, you know, the middle linebacker was pretty much the quarterback of the defense.
That's exactly right. It still is. Well, it should be today, but somebody's got to be. It depends on the individual. And that's why I played as long as I did, because I could do both. I could run the defense, call the signals, and I was very sharp at it. In other words, I'll give you for example, okay? We're playing the San Diego Chargers. I think I might have told you this. But we didn't have Earl Campbell. Pastorini was up. Kenny Burrow was out. We're going to get killed. So the defense coordinator came to me and he said, Greg, I think I picked up a tip. And I said, okay. And he said, we're playing Dan Fouts.
And this is a playoff game, right? This is the AFC divisional playoff.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he said, every time Dan Fouts puts his feet in parallel, he's running the ball. And every time he passes the ball, the left guard steps back with his left foot, so he steps on Fouts' foot. So Fouts drops his right foot about 6 or 7 inches. He says, it's 100%. Take a look at it. And he says, here's what we're going to do. Every time, and when you're in his feet, I don't want you to yell out where the ball's going or anything. I just want you to go Army for running and Air Force for passing. And it worked every time. Every single time.
And that was a great win for the Oilers. And, you know, Vernon Perry, 4 interceptions that game and a blocked field goal. He had a tremendous game on defense. J.C. Wilson made an interception. Alvin Bethea and Curly Culp got a lot of pressure on the quarterbacks. All of you guys made great plays. And and one thing that always stuck with me when I interviewed Vernon about that game, he said everybody was talking about how our offensive players were out, but nobody talked about our defense. And
That's right.
You guys had a great, exceptional defense.
Yeah, we did. We really did. And had great pieces. And the pieces have to fit together to make a complete puzzle, if that makes sense to you.
Certainly.
So we had all it all going for us. The only problem that we had was the Pittsburgh Steelers. And they had Terry Bradshaw and 32 and Rocky Blyer and John Stallworth. And so they arguably the best football team to ever play.
Right, and they were in your division, which complicated it even more. Now, what stands out to you about that Steeler offense and going against them? What were their tendencies, and what do you think made them great?
Well, one of the things was Franco Harris, who just died, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a perfect trapping running back. Franco would wait and had the patience for the trap hole to open up. And what I'm saying to you is, you know, the defensive line is either going to slant right or slant left. You follow me? So you're going to slant one way or the other. There's always games going on. Nothing's vanilla. So if you run a 39 trap and you slant to the right, then you got to run the trap to the 7 hole, not the 9 hole, because of the slants of the defensive line.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that Franco did real well, you see, because he understood exactly what he needed to do, and that is wait for the hole to open up. Just the opposite of Earl Campbell. If Earl Campbell was going to that hole, if there wasn't one, he'd try and make one. And Franco is just the opposite. Use his quick feet. And that's why sometimes they busted Franco, and they used to make fun of him, in other words, like he'd run out of bounds or something. And it was just stupid, because what he was an intelligent back. In other words, why go in there and take that whooping just for an extra 2 inches? So he would run to the sidelines, get every inch that he possibly could, and then he just wouldn't turn it up. He just continued to run out of bounds. And it was smart, because he did get a few personal fouls called against the defensive player who hit him when he ran out of bounds.
Fantastic insight there from Greg Bingham, linebacker for the Houston Oilers for 12 seasons, telling us one aspect that made Franco Harris great: his ability to run that trap play. You can hear Steelers Hall of Fame linebacker Jack Hamm talk about the Steelers-Oilers rivalry in episode 63 of the Game Before the Money podcast. That is available on all major podcast apps and at thegamebeforethemoney.com. Coming up, Greg Bingham is going to give more insight on how he read plays from the linebacker position. Some of these are tips that you can use watching games on television. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Back with Greg Bingham, who played inside linebacker for the Houston Oilers for 12 NFL seasons, led the team in tackles for the vast majority of those seasons. He's going to talk about some more clues that he would read from the offense to know whether a pass or a run was likely to come.
I got to talk with Leroy Jordan one time. He mentioned that he watched a lot of game film, and from that, he was able to read what was going to happen. And then he'd tell his teammates what was gonna happen, and he'd direct his teammates pre-snap. Is that kind of what you did too?
Absolutely. So you've got to realize that an offensive backfield tells you everything. It's just like a boxer. Whether he's right-handed, then you know where his jab is, and you know where his knockout punch is. And if he's left-handed, it's just the opposite. So there are tendencies and actual things that have to happen depending on the backfield set. In other words, if you're in the I formation, you can't get outside in that formation. And the reason is simple, because you've got too far for the fullback to go. So you're pretty much have to going to run inside the tackles. A full formation is another thing that tells you where they can go. In a full formation, you're either going to pass the ball or you're going to have to run a Green Bay sweep. Yes, you throw in a little draw every once in a while just to throw your tendencies off. But it's really like boxing. And the offense lines up so you know exactly where the right hook is and you know where the jab is.
And then you you direct from the middle linebacker, you're directing guys as far as where to go then, or what the play might be.
Right. That's exactly right. So there's other things that you got to realize, and that is tips. In other words, when offensive linemen, and they're pretty big guys, so they're not as flexible as they should be or could be, but when they're pulling, they will let you know that they're pulling. You can see by the weight they put on their hands.
So are they not putting as much weight?
Right.
They're
pulling, yeah. Huh? On their hands, right. So when they're drive blocking, you know, you put your hand down and it actually cuts off the circulation in your fingers if you're going to run block. And if you're going to pass block, they turn white. And if you're going to run block, they turn red.
Oh, really? And you could see that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. But you got to put all this information into your brain right at the time of the play is going off. And you've got to also realize that when you call a play as a quarterback, you have to call out the formation, who's going to carry the ball, and what hole they're going to run to. So if you're going to run a play, a running play, and you say, pro right, 28 blast on 2. So first of all, I read your lips. You told me what the snap count is. Secondly, how long you talked, you told me that it was going to be a run. Because if it was going to be a pass, you go pro right, slot left, X turn, Z out, Y post. So just by the length of you talking, you're telling me what the play is.
So a longer play call, you're going to recognize that as pass.
Exactly, because he's telling the 5 receivers what they're supposed to run.
Wow, that's fascinating insight. It sounds, you know, like you learned the game really well, and that was one of maybe your strengths, was just your intelligence and your ability to think added on to your athletic ability.
That's exactly right. And I take that same approach into business.
Mm-hmm.
The exact same approach. In other words, quarterback goes in the huddle and he goes pro right, slot left, 22, X turn, Y post, A swing, B block. So that length of time talking, he's telling all the receivers what to do. So you already know that it should be a pass.
Well, Greg, is there anything else you think is important to say about your career or those Oilers at that time?
Well, that's a good question. I always thought I could negotiate my own contracts, because why would I want to pay an agent 10%? And you got to realize that my rookie year, I started all 20 games, and I made $19,500. And my second year, I negotiated my contracts myself. I was supposed to make $23,500, but since I started all 20, the general manager came to me and he said, "Listen, Greg, I'm going to tear up your $23,500 contract for $74,000, and I'm going to give you $50,000." He came to me. I didn't ask. He came to me. And I thought that was great. And that made me a very loyal player, if that makes sense to you.
Certainly.
But when you go tell somebody that you made $19,500 and started all 20 games, they're going to scratch their heads at you because they don't understand the inflation. My rookie year in $19,500 was 3 times the mean of Americans. And I bought a brand new Corvette in 74, and it cost me $5,900.
All right, that was former Houston Oiler and Purdue Boilermaker, Greg Bingham, with some great NFL insight, some great NFL history into salaries as well. Those of you who read the book, The Game Before the Money, might remember I had an appendix in there that calculated player salaries from the 30s through the 1970s in current dollars. And I did that for Greg's rookie salary of $19,500 in 1973, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator. That equals about $131,000 today. So that gives you kind of an idea of what NFL players were making. Now, besides some of those tips that Greg gave you, I actually got to see Greg this week. And I've talked to other players about this. In fact, Dallas Cowboys legend Walt Garrison, in the book The Game Before the Money, talked about tips that he read. And some of it is foot placement. And you can tell a lot from foot placement. And check it out when you watch games this weekend. You'll probably see players who have their feet parallel. You'll probably see them a lot of times move from side to side rather than forward at the snap of the ball. And players who line up with one foot in front of the other, a lot of times they're going to run forward at the snap of the ball. So you can kind of tell pre-snap. These are fan on the couch pre-snap reads that you can do on your own. You don't have to be a football genius. You don't have to have a background in coaching football to read some of the things that are about to happen on the field. A lot of things also players learn from film. And to close this segment, I'll share with you a story that Hall of Famer Ken Houston shared with me about stopping Walt Garrison on the goal line at the end of a Monday Night Football game. It was a very famous play at the time. And Ken said he knew exactly what was going to happen from watching game film and watching what route the tight end ran to know where the ball was going to go. So a lot of times when you see players making big plays, oftentimes it comes from watching game film, studying what happens when a tight end goes a certain way. That's some of the inner workings of the game. And you can learn that too. If you pay really close attention watching your team throughout the season, you can maybe pick up those tendencies from your own team. And one last thing, Ken Houston went to Prairie View A&M, an HBCU located in Prairie View, Texas. And I got to go there this past week and do some research on their College Football Hall of Fame coach, Billy Nix. He's a name that every fan should know, in my opinion. He was Ken Houston's college coach. He was Otis Taylor's college coach. A lot of his players went on to the NFL, and he won several HBCU national championships, 5 at Prairie View A&M. And it was a real pleasure to go out there, see some of the trophies that he had won over his career, and read about some of that great history of that school. I also got to visit the Texas Southern campus this week and do some research there. That's Michael Strahan's alma mater. So if you enjoy football history, don't forget about HBCU football history, because a lot of Hall of Famers played at those HBCUs. I've started a page on thegamebeforethemoney.com dedicated to HBCU history. So be sure to visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Coming up next, we'll hear from another NFL legend, the great Chuck Foreman of the Minnesota Vikings. All right, on the line, Minnesota Vikings great Chuck Foreman played fullback for the Vikings, starting in the 1973 season, helped them win 3 NFC championships. His nickname was the Spin Doctor. He had this great spin move, and he was an exceptional player. He had 22 touchdowns one year in a 14-game season. He not only was a great rusher, he was an excellent receiver as well. Fantastic all-around player. In fact, he played multiple positions in high school and at the University of Miami. Here's Chuck Foreman.
When you were drafted by the Vikings in the first round and you show up to training camp, did Bud Grant tell you we're going to try you out at different positions, or did they have you pegged at running back at that point?
when they drafted me and I was in a meeting with a general manager, Jim Finks, he asked me at that point, where do I want to play? And I told him I'd play running back because I had won every MVP in every game I played and as a running back. So that was why I made that choice.
And you had a great game against the Bears in 77 with the 150 yards rushing. I think he had a lot of yards receiving that day. You were the kind of the original all-purpose back.
Well, I would say that maybe I took it to a different level, but before me, there was a guy by the name, when I was a kid, there was a guy named Bobby Mitchell, all-purpose. There was a gentleman by the name of Lenny Moore, all-purpose. And then when I was in college, there was a guy named Jim Kick, all-purpose. There could be a lot more, but those were the ones that I watched that were pretty much all-purpose backs and could do pretty much everything. I just happened to take it to a different level.
Yeah, you certainly did. In 1975, you had three touchdowns in back-to-back games, and you had three touchdowns in five games. Was everything just clicking for you, or was the offense designed for you to score a lot? Or
no, man, that's not the way it works, man. It's like as a receiver, as a running back, as a quarterback, you so-called skill position people, the only way we have success and to get to do the things that we can do that can showcase our individual skills is if you have the people in place that is going to give you what you need. Like, for instance, as a running back, is this lineman going to give me the opportunity to get to the second level where my individual skill set will come in? For the quarterback, is he going to get the time to throw the football, to read the defense, to do what he has for the wide receiver? Is he going to run the right pattern and identify what defense is coming in the quarterback read and get the ball to him? And all that takes, you know, it's what's up front that counts. Without the lineman on the offensive or defensive side, nothing happens. Now, the linebackers, the running backs, the receivers, the corners, they get all the ink. But the guys that make it happen are the guys up front. And that's how I visualize football and the way I think about football. So, what do I do? When you ask me about the games that I had three touchdowns in, then that tells me that the offensive line was doing what they were supposed to do and I was doing what I was supposed to do. Certainly my talents come into play. But my talents don't come into play unless everybody else is doing their thing. You see, that's just the way to go.
Right. You had some great guys in front of you with Mick Tinglehoff and Ron Yeary are both in the Hall of Fame. And is there anything else important that you'd...
Well, I don't know. I appreciate the call and everything, but, you know, as I said, you know, if I had to say anything, when you look at football players or athletes in general, you got to look at the time and the era in which they played. I certainly don't compare my era to that football player or the era of today, because it's a totally different game, a totally different everything as far as the game itself is concerned. You know, the rule changes, you know, the number of games you play, the protections that they have in for the players now that they didn't have in back then, the offenses, and you know, it's in the at a time when they were converting from, you know, run dominating offense to opening the game up to a passing game too. All kinds of things that, you know, that I experienced in my time. And then when I watch the game today, see, I can't compare, for instance, I don't compare statistics of today to statistics back when I played. Well, number one, there's 14 games. Number two, the rule changes. There's so many different things that players can do now that they couldn't do back then. And just a total approach to the game of football is different. So each era, it should be judged differently. I don't believe in the word GOAT. I don't think there ain't no greatest of all time. You might be the greatest of your era, but you can't say that you're the greatest of all time because, number one, you know, well, you can't judge it by yards you make or how many catches you make. you know, because those things are different. When my era, when we played football, for instance, as a wide receiver, they had the bump and run in, which meant that the guy could get up on you and bump you all the way downfield until that ball was released. Now they can't touch you. So if you can't get out and catch, you know, 100 balls, then I don't know why you can't, because it's easy to do. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it took a long time for anybody except Lionel Taylor and Charlie Hennigan to have over 100 catches.
So when you go back and you're doing your homework, which it sounds like you've done a lot of it, I'm just saying, when you are talking about players in the game itself, think about, before you say who's the greatest and who can do this and who can do that, you know, that's the ultimate team sport, this game of football. And everything any individual does, he ain't done it on his own. Certainly he showcases some individual talents, whether he can catch the ball, run a route, can run the football and all that kind of stuff. But all the people that are involved, for him to be able to showcase that, you got to remember that the rules have changed. For instance, offensive linemen hold every play now. The only difference is, you know, you can't have your hands outside. If you got them inside and you're grabbing and holding and touching, you know, it's okay. So when you start evaluating players, you know, you put the stats aside, because the stats are not a great indicator of how good that guy is. You know, it's the era they played in. And so if you're going to compare a quarterback, certainly for the last 10 years, the quarterbacks of the last 10 years, compare them to those guys. But I can tell you, some of the quarterbacks that I played and watched it play, if they had what the quarterbacks had today, which is protection, heck, they might have 30,000 passing yards. That's how good they were. Or running back. You know, if they played, if you could hold like that, hey, we all have at least 10,000 yards. Easy. So I'm just saying, man, about the game, a beautiful game, the ultimate team sport. And you see it, you love it, you watch guys play, and guys that you think that have done well, and I appreciate the respect you're giving me for giving me this phone call to interview me, because that tells me, you know, I must have done something right. But yeah, as far as my game and in my era, I was the first to do it that way. But when people compare me to the guys that played the game in my time as running back, in fact, I was a fullback. I bet you didn't know that.
I did see it listed. Yeah. And not a halfback.
No, fullback. You see what I'm saying? And so when people look at my game, they say, oh, look at his stats. And they just look at my stats from the line of scrimmage when they try to compare me to whoever. And one of the major parts of my game is the fact that, you know, I was so versatile, you know, that I had a part of my game that none of the other guys could do. And they don't even incorporate that in all the things that I accomplish in the game when they come to evaluate me for maybe the Hall of Fame. They don't even look at that part. They look at yards from the line of scrimmage. But the other part of my game, which separated me from everybody else, they don't even take that into consideration. That's why I say I don't believe in all that GOAT stuff. I think, you know, I give guys the recognition that they deserve for the successes they've had. More power to them. But then when you have people evaluating you or me or whomever as a talent, then evaluate them for the whole, not for the part that you want to evaluate them with.
All right, that was Chuck Foreman, Minnesota Vikings legend, complete football player. In fact, he was named Sporting News NFC Player of the Year in 1974, and UPI NFC Most Valuable Player in 1976. You can find Chuck Foreman on Twitter, at Chuck Foreman. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money. Tune in next Saturday, 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 Central, and visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Also, check out the Game Before the Money podcast.